Brooklyn, Queens, the Bronx, Staten, and money-making Manhattan. You're listening to Bashani Radio App, the number one independent app for podcast. Download for free for iPhone and Android at the App Store.
You're listening to The Spectrum with Bob Ivory and Ivory Coast Media Production.
Greetings and welcome once again, ladies and gentlemen, to The Spectrum with Bob Ivory. I was thinking about what I wanted to share with the Spectrum listeners when it occurred to me. It occurred to me that there may be listeners, both current and brand spanking new, who actually may not know what this show is about. So today, just for you, just because you're special, I will tell you why I call this show The Spectrum with Bob Ivory. You see, the word spectrum indicates a broad range of colorful topics with varied colorful personalities and stories of people you may have heard of, as well as those it may be your delight to discover for the very first time. Why do I tag the show with my name? Branding, baby. Branding. You see, I can't have you streaming the wrong podcast that may hypnotize you into thinking you're a spy from the planet Bantar, and that you should immediately cover yourself in Cool Whip to access the wormhole that will transport you back to your home base. I clearly brand the name of the show to spare you that kind of embarrassment. You're welcome. Besides, everyone knows that wormholes can only be accessed using extra chunky jiff. And remember, you don't need a knife to jiff. To put it very simply, we're talking life in living color. So, in the spirit of sharing, caring, and friendship, I present a kind of spectrum smorgasbord of show guests, from authors to a twin judge who served as a judge with her twin, who was also a judge, to a high school dropout whose teachers essentially told him he'd never amount to anything, who is now well on his way to not just being a millionaire. No, he's on his way to billionaire status, if in fact he hasn't reached it by now. And to me, sharing from my 20 plus years as a personal development coach and brand manager to share ideas that may shift how you see yourself and how you see the world around you. Bon appetit, my friends. I think you're going to enjoy it. And sorry, I'm all out of jiff. We have a fantastic guest with us today in the person of Elaine Mackus, PhD. Let's find a little bit about her. Elaine completed her doctorate in educational leadership at Oakland University in 2010. She has a specialist degree from Saginaw Valley State University in educational leadership, a master's from Central Michigan University in school guidance, and a bachelor's from Western Michigan University in history. Elaine is a strong advocate for education. She spent over 40 years in the educational capacity of a professor of educational leadership at the University of Michigan, public school teacher, administrator, director of educational services, and teacher of professional development. Elaine was a private coach for failing schools in the areas of curriculum and accreditation through her company, Curriculum Connections, LLC. After finally retiring from the world of education, she has devoted her time to tell the wonderful, important, and heartwarming story of her dad's battlefield journey during the Southern invasion of Germany in 1944. Ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome author Elaine Mackis, PhD. Greetings, Elaine.
Greetings. Thank you for having me.
It's absolutely a pleasure to have you on. Your book is called A Young Man on the Front Line, Lessons of War. Let me begin by asking you, what inspired you to write this book?
First and foremost, it was the love and respect I had for my father.
Okay.
And also his generation and the men that he had under him. He was a sergeant in World War II, and I think for all of them, their lives were forever changed, and that's something that we should never forget. The second reason is back to me being an educator.
Right.
I know from being a teacher that we learn best by human story. I always had to give my students something that they could Velcro their mind to.
Brilliant.
We don't attach to facts and figures. I mean, they're useful, but we don't attach to them. So as the years go by, the way to keep the honor and sacrifice of other Americans alive is for us to connect to their story.
Okay.
And this was a wonderful story of sacrifice and trauma and triumph. And Colonel Kokal, who was from the 63rd Reserve Division, he wrote an endorsement for the book, and he said something that I think really sums it up. He says, "Sergeant Chris Mackis was a cast member of a generation."
Wow. Say that one more time. What was that? What was that phrase?
Chris Mackis, Sergeant Chris Mackis, mm-hmm. was a cast member of a generation.
Ah, okay.
So it sort of explains that his story is so many story. You know, so many of the veteran stories,
mm-hmm.
And so. By reading the story and being pulled into the story and being right there in the battlefield with my father and his men kind of gives you an understanding of World War II, but also of all soldiers and all trauma.
Hmm.
And that was important.
Sure. You were, I read that you and your father had a close relationship. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. My father was a widower for over 20 years. And so he was by himself. And I have a brother and a sister. And, you know, we were a close family. But I did a lot with my father over those 20 years. And we were very close, and I think he shared with me things he never shared with anybody.
Wow. Well, I guess that really gives you some great insight into writing this particular story then.
Right. Yes, it did.
So as it relates to your father, what are three characteristics that stand out or describe your father?
My father was a quiet man. He was stoic, quite dignified. You get the feeling that he was always on duty. He was always like standing guard, you know what I mean?
Okay.
Over his family, over anybody, you know. He was like, and even when he was in hospice, he'd say to me, well, you know, who's on guard duty tonight? he could read a situation, perceive what the objective should be, and take action before you even had a thought. You know,
sure.
I mean, and just like that. And I think that that came from his wartime experience. But despite the fact that he was a quiet man, oh my gosh, he had the best sense of humor and the deepest laugh. And we would sit with him as little kids and watch the Three Stooges, you know, and laugh and laugh and laugh. So, which is old time humor. It's not humor anymore, but it was back then.
I understand. All right. I'm sorry. Was that three of them that I
We said, let me see.
You said he was quiet.
Yeah, a quiet, stoic, and dignified man. And then, but that was all kind of together. Then the fact that he could read a situation and know what to do, like, immediately, and then take action before, you know, anybody else figured what was going on. Like, he always said, and it's in the book, and he explains why, but he always says, you must be aware of your surroundings at all times.
Indeed. That is actually something I used to tell my granddaughters all the time.
Yeah.
Always be aware of your surroundings.
That's right. And so that was a lesson he learned, and he lived by it, and he taught us to live by it, too.
Wow, that's excellent. Sounds like a wonderful person to know. And the people, you will get a chance to know him in your own way in this wonderful book. Let me ask you a few more questions. Are there any portions of the book that were difficult for you to share or to write?
Yes. I kind of got through the chronology of the battles. And kind of weaving in with the battles, the stories he told that were funny about him and his men and finding, you know, stashes of wine in the cellars. And then, of course, there'd be the hard times of the battles and who they lost and even the capturing of German soldiers and, you know, and how they learned about humanity. But what was really difficult for me to write was it in the end. Before my father passed, we went to Washington, D.C., so he could give his testimony at the U.S. Holocaust Memorial Museum, because part of his story is they liberated a concentration camp outside of Laingsburg that was a satellite of Dachau. And so he told his story to them. So he was considered a liberator.
Okay.
And at that time, he began speaking to me about things that were very, very deep. Hmm. And in the last few days of his life, I would sit there and hold his hand. And he talked about the trauma, the sacrifice, the devastation of war, how we seem to forget these things. And, you know, he looks around society and sees us, you know, arguing with each other. And he just showed me some of the wounds that do not heal and the losses. And he told me that every man he lost, he started with 5 under him and ended up with 19. Hmm. Every man he lost, he lit a candle for him in church every Sunday. So he never forgot them. But to be hearing this and knowing that his life was ebbing away was really hard. Hmm. It was hard for me to relive that and put it in there, but it's there.
No, well, thank you. I appreciate your transparency, because I think that there will be some significance in those that will be able to relate to the experience, though it was painful. But I do appreciate, once again, your transparency and having the courage to do that.
Thank you.
Let's see. What do you want the reader to experience as a result of reading your book? What do you want them to come away with?
A few things. I think I want my readers, like we talked about a little before, to experience World War II through a true story that kind of is the chronology of history, along with the human story, the facing of humanity, the horrors people face and come back from. So so to sort of align with that, I wanted my reader to be able to relate my father's journey to their own journey, okay. their own trials. Everybody has trials. So, everybody has trauma and tribulation. And, you know, sometimes we triumph and sometimes we struggle a long time. But to understand the lessons they learned and that I interwove within the book, in the own, their own lives, the reader's own lives, because trauma hides. It hides very well. And to be able to look at ourselves is not an easy thing to do. But I think that if you look at somebody's story, and then you think about your story, because everybody has a story.
Certainly.
I would want them to learn from about themselves from that. The other thing is I really want the reader to see how much we all love our country. I think in America, and I've traveled in other places in the world, in the Far East and, you know, Europe and areas, we love our country and we believe in its ideals, but we don't have the same idea of how to pursue them. But yet we're all proud. We're all proud Certainly. Of the idea of both the common good and individual rights living in the same society, in the same principles of government. It's not an easy row to hoe. And my father said to me, he said, there's no place like America. There's no place. When we got home, we actually literally kissed the ground. And, so it's, I think it's important, Bobby, don't you think so, for Absolutely. Us to sometimes like look at our values and what we're trying to do and maintain that. And they were strong, man. They were one tough generation.
Yeah. I agree with you 100% there. Absolutely.
Yeah. So I think those three things are what I really hope for my reader to have, an experience of World War II, a relationship between my father's journey and their own journey, mm-hmm. and then an understanding of the love and sacrifice we all have for our ideals.
Is March Women's History Month. We're going to hear from a Detroit living legend, Judge Leonia Lloyd. We had her on before a few months ago and didn't get to hear all of it, so we're going to roll back the wheels of time and hear some more wisdom from Judge Leonia Lloyd. All right, let's talk about your memoir. Let's talk about your book a little bit. Why is it so important? Why was it so important for you to write this particular book?
Well, I wanted to get across to my readers the message that they can never, never give up on their dreams. Mm. Too many times, I saw people in my courtrooms who had given up a long time ago, and that was just not acceptable to me. Okay, that wasn't acceptable. Mm. And my job was to reignite in them a flame so that they could go after something that they wanted to achieve.
Sure.
And, you know, I've had them for 2 years, so by the time those 2 years were over, we saw people accomplishing something they thought they had never, ever would do. They gave up, and it showed them that they gave up too soon.
Mm.
And so my whole thing was to, you know, Leona and I had talked about this, and she was one of the reasons I did this book, because we both wanted people to understand that you have to dream, and even if you dream that impossible dream, understand you can make it possible. You just can't quit.
Mm.
You just can't quit. And that's the main thing. You cannot quit. I don't care what happens. I don't care the fact that, you know, things crumble around you no matter what.
Mm-hmm.
You have to pick up the pieces. You can have failures, learn from them, keep moving, and keep going. This is why it was important for me to write this book. This was a message we always wanted to push, because we had been through so many things in our life that would normally put people back.
Sure,
it would have been easy for us, you know, to stop. And, you know, particularly when my mother got sick and how, you know, she made it difficult for us to study in college.
Right.
And to say, well, forget this, let me go get a job, and I move, and I just make some money and get an apartment.
Okay.
And forget the dream about going to school. Forget that. I got to get away from here because my mother's not acting right.
Wow.
That was not possible to me and Leona. Leona and I said, this was our dream. My mother had brainwashed us since we were little to go to college.
Wow.
And because she had those problems with the nervous breakdown, with the subarachnoid hemorrhages and all of that, we had been brainwashed thoroughly by her.
Wow.
So I looked at her one day and I said, I don't care what you do to us. She turned the lights off so we couldn't study.
Right.
I said, I don't care what you do. I said, but we are going to stay in school. I said, you have made that something for us to believe in, and it's too late for you to take it back now.
Wow.
We said, you did a real good job at brainwashing. I said, and we're not quitting. I looked at my mother and said, we're not quitting. She could turn the lights off. She could do whatever she wanted to do. But it was, you know, we just had to then regroup and you replan.
Wow.
And our thing was, we're going to have to move on to campus because next mama's going to take the car and then we won't be able to drive to school. How are we going to get there? How are we going to lug all these books on a bus? And so then we went and we started interviewing for jobs on campus. We got that. We then went into the dorm and got the applications. And January the next year, we made the move.
Wow.
It's like you have the dream.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to make sure it happens. You've got to make sure you take the steps. And you're going to hit potholes and you're going to hit all these negative things. Deal with it and keep moving. Keep it moving. And that's the main purpose of this book and what we both wanted to get across. And we both planned to write it together, but of course she passed.
Sure. Well, that had to be some pretty extraordinary circumstances early on in your life. So, I mean, that's a lesson in itself. I mean, how were you at that particular time when you were dealing with the issues with your mother?
We were in high school. Everything to us was going along pretty good.
Okay.
We were chosen to be the high school commencement speakers, and we were the first black ones at Mumford to do this. My mother had been a valedictorian, so she had spoken for her class in high school as well as her nursing school.
Okay.
So she was helping us with the speeches, and she was being the mother that we knew, the mother that loved us and you know, nurtured us, et cetera.
Right.
But a few weeks before we were to actually, you know, get up there at our commencement, graduation, my mother had a nervous breakdown.
Wow.
And totally became someone we didn't know. And we were there at the hospital, the psych ward with my father, and we're like, you know, 16.
We turned
17 in August that year, but we were 16. And we knew she wasn't acting right. She was seeing Jesus on the TV screen, and Jesus wasn't there.
Wow.
And when you don't know what that is, and you're a teenager, and my mother, we would sit and watch TV with her all the time. We did stuff with my mother all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And so when she said, you see Jesus there? I said, huh? And she said, right there. I said, well, Mama, what are you looking at? I said, and I named who was on the screen. And I laughed because me and my sister said, Larry, Jesus ain't on the screen. And so she said, yes, he is. I said, no, he's not. I said, then I stopped laughing.
Wow.
And I looked at my mother because she looked serious. And I said, Mama, do you still see him on the screen? And she looked at me and my sister and then she knew that's the wrong answer to give. So she said, no. And so that was the beginning of us realizing when she would sit at night. And for those of us who are old enough to remember, the TV did go off at night. And it didn't. It didn't play all day and all
right.
night.
Like, I remember that.
Right. And so, you know,
Star Spangled Banner comes on, right.
Right. She was sitting up watching a blank screen.
Hmm.
Wow. And so we would come in there and say, Mama, what you looking at? Ain't I know?
Hmm.
And then she would get up and she'd go and get in the bed. Well, all of these were signs that, you know, the delusions and things like this were going on, but we didn't know. And then when she really started acting out and, you know, getting, you know, really mean and nasty and hitting at my father and running out the door, no
right.
clothes on and stuff like that, he said, I've taken your mother to the hospital. He said, meet me down. And when we got there and we're looking and well, why are we here? Why are we in this unit?
Hmm.
And, you know, we didn't know. We didn't understand. And when the doctor, you know, was explaining to us, he said, she's had a nervous breakdown. And he said, well, what causes that? And he said, depression. Hmm. I said, depression about what? And she said, because my mother was cheerful all the time. And he said, only she knows.
Wow.
And that's something that, you know, we're going to have to put her in some counseling to see. Well, counseling back then was not like it is today.
Right.
And so her counseling consisted of, you know, Miss Lloyd, what are you depressed about? And then she said nothing. And then that was it. You keep taking your meds. And she, back then they had a method where they would hook you up and basically shock you.
Electroshock therapy?
Yep.
Wow.
And she couldn't take that. She couldn't take it because she had had a subarachnoid hemorrhage before.
Mm.
And the subarachnoid hemorrhage, we were five. And we remember the ambulance coming, you know, to get her because they had got us out of school. And all she told us was to mind our father and to do what he said. She just didn't feel well. And they took her away in the truck. And so, you know, she was there for several months. But she told my father, she said, don't let them go in my head. She said, because if they do, I won't come back the same.
Hmm.
And you have to promise me. And so she remembered this, and at least she remembers telling it to us when, you know, when she came out, she was much, much better. But she said, my father, he was inundated with questions, and we need to do this. We need to bore a hole in her head. We need to get the fluid out. We need to. My father said no. And he said, but you don't understand. She could die. He said, no. She told me, no. She told me not to let you go in her head. And they said, well, if she does live, she'll probably either be blind, and she would be. They had a whole list of negatives for my father.
Right.
And he said, I understand. He said no. He wouldn't pray it in the chapel.
Hmm.
And the thing is that she didn't die. Every day he came in there, when the doctors came, they saw she hadn't died, but she was blind. She couldn't see.
Hmm.
And this is when she first opened her eyes. It took a while before she even opened her eyes back up. And then when she could see my father, she just said, you know, who are you? And he said, I'm your husband. She said, I'm married.
Hmm.
And he said, yes, and you have two little twin girls. They're 5 years old. And she said, I have kids. My mother didn't remember anything.
Wow.
And the sad thing I write about in the book is that she, when you have that, it's considered like a bleeding stroke.
Mm.
And if you know anybody who's had a stroke, it takes away a lot of the memory.
Wow.
It takes away a lot of your skills. People who have strokes normally can't continue doing the jobs that they have done. And they're either going to be fired, or, you know, or they quit. They can't do the job.
Right.
They go through counseling today to reinvent their lives, to readjust and see what you can do. Or they get on assistance, because they can't do the job they did before.
Right.
Well, my mother couldn't either. She couldn't either, but there was not anybody telling her anything or counseling her. My father didn't understand why she wouldn't go back to work after 10 years. He didn't understand. She still was a nurse. She still kept her reciprocity up.
Mm-hmm.
And she just kept saying no. She told her girlfriends who were nurses, they said, come on, Naomi, you can do this. You can do this. Just follow us and just, you know, follow us. It'll all come back to you. The fact that they said it'll all come back to you they knew as nurses, Mama had lost some of that brain power that she had. And because they were nurses, they just didn't know the degree. And I used to hear, you know, my parents who were the other grown-ups, and I'd hear someone ask my father, are you going to stay or are you going to leave? And my father said, I'm not going anywhere. He said, this is my wife, for better or for worse.
Wow.
And he said, I have two little girls, and he said, I'm not going anywhere.
On our show today, the one, the only, Mr. Benny Randall Jr. I know you've experienced great hardships on the way to your success, but do you remember the moment your mind shift changed and why?
I think my mind shift changed when I was a dancer because what happened, I got around people. Well, I see that they were getting paid large amounts of money for doing what they actually love.
Okay.
And that was a new thing to me, to get paid a lot of money doing something you actually love. So that's when I realized, you know, they would go on stage and be on there for like 10, 15 minutes and get thousands of dollars. I was like, this is the business I need to be in.
Wow. So I know in your coaching business, you talk a lot about the mindset. Why is the proper mindset such a big deal? Why is it so important?
The mindset creates the world you experience. That's what most people don't realize, that what you have in your life was created by you. So if you feel like you're lacking at this moment, it's because your mindset is lacking. It's just that simple. You created the environment you're in. No one else created that environment. Somewhere along the line, you believed you could or you believe you couldn't. Okay, as the old saying goes, back in the days, that says, you know, whether you say you can or you can't, you're right on both occasions. So I tell people, if you look at your life and you're not happy, it's because you haven't done enough and you haven't changed your mindset enough to actually get the abundance that exists. Because,
wow,
see, God is abundance. People think that, you know, God wants you to be broke or whatever. No, God is abundance. He's everything. So if he's your father, he's everything, you don't have everything, I think it's probably partially due to the child of how that's applied what his father has already told him was his. So that's where the mindset comes in. You are a co-creator. Your father tells you that you can have it all and you don't have it all, it just means that you didn't really pay attention. You are not applying the aspects of your mindset. That's what they call it, mindset, to get what you want. So if you have lack, it's because somewhere in your mindset, you believe in lack. It's just that simple. Lack doesn't just show up in your life. You have to attract it the same way you attract success. You have to attract lack. And that's what people don't realize. So when you're complaining about those bills and you know those are bills, you're doing exactly what you would be doing. It's just the opposite of success. That's it. It's simply the opposite of what it is to grow. And you go.
Wow. Now, do you remember in your own life a time of having a lack mindset?
Oh, of course, when I was young, I thought I was the black sheep of the family. I thought I wasn't, you know, I had, you know, the brothers and the sister and, you know, where I come from, it was all about whether you're light skin or dark skin and,
wow,
you know, how you look and all of that mattered, you know, so me being the dark skin brother, you know what I mean? I didn't get the girls. They wasn't running after me. They wasn't bringing my phone off the hook and nothing like that. So, you know, I believe that there was something wrong with me.
Wow.
You know, like I wasn't special. And what I realized is that I really was special. I just didn't have the mindset to understand it. So therefore, I produced that lack that I seen instead of that growth that was within.
Wow. That is something. So do those memories, do they still push you to this day? Childhood and those types of experiences that you had, do they still push you to this day?
Well, what they do, they allow me to help other people because I can always call on them and remember the time when I didn't feel as strong as I should have felt. And then that way I'm able to relate to that person that I may be communicating with to understand why they feel that way. You understand? So remember, I tell people, if you ever want to be successful, only teach what you know.
Mm.
Only teach what you experience. If you ever want to be successful, only teach what you experience. The problem is most people try to teach stuff they never experienced.
Exactly.
And that's where everybody has the problems come in. And that's why you have successful and unsuccessful coaches and, you know, advisors and things, because, you know, many are teaching things that they never experienced or they never were successful in. So it's hard to call on. It's hard to teach somebody to be successful if you're not.
Right. I would imagine, especially when it comes to money, because people, they feel like can pull the wool over people's eyes and use a few buzzwords about money and abundance. Really, they don't really know. They may have read something about it, but they don't. That's not their personal experience as it relates to wealth.
But you got to remember, very simple, in order for you to pull the wool over somebody's eyes, you have to first pull the wool over your eyes. Hmm. So you have to deceive yourself in order to deceive the next man.
Wow. So what does self-deception look like?
Look at the person in the White House. You gotta say more.
Okay.
You know, it works for him and it works against him. You know, it worked for him because he believed that he could actually be president. It worked against him because what he was actually doing wasn't what was actually happening. So eventually it caught up with him. You understand? So
sure.
He's the perfect example of self-deception.
Wow. Okay. You talked about abundance before. And so let's talk about financial success. Why is financial success important to you? And also, if you can add to it, why should it be important to other people that have not yet achieved it?
Okay. I think you said why is financial success
important to you?
Because, very simply, how you gonna feed somebody if you're hungry? If you understand what I'm saying? If your plate is empty, how you gonna feed me?
Right.
You have to have some success to be able to supply others. I don't care if you have a nonprofit. Even nonprofits have to have money in order to run the nonprofit. Go figure.
Right.
They need some type of funding from somewhere, whether it's from government or it's from private entities. You know, you can't help nobody if you can't help yourself. Like, I don't understand why this is so hard for people to believe. Like, you know, okay, I'll just go out here and beg what I need to help other people. No, you're doing it wrong. You should make enough so that you can then, in return, share that overabundance with others. That's the right way to do it.
Hmm.
You know, when people go the opposite way, they go in with underabundance, and then when it starts to run low, they say, well, I need help because I'm trying to help all these people. Well, first try helping yourself.
Right.
Don't come to me if you're hungry and then trying to feed me.
It is important to understand that passion does not equal ability. I'm going to say that again. Passion does not equal ability. Just because you're passionate about something doesn't mean you're good at it. Some people are passionate about cooking. They love to watch all the cooking shows. But despite that, some people just can't cook. It's not their gift. They haven't been gifted to cook, but they keep trying to cook. They keep cooking and they keep getting people to sample whatever it is they're whipping up. And people are spitting it out. They don't want to eat it because it doesn't taste good. It's important to understand that you must marry passion with ability. I'm going to say that one more time. You must marry passion with ability. So that's why I say do what seems effortless, not necessarily what you have a passion for. We can have a passion for a lot of things, designing clothes. We might even have a passion for going to the moon, outer space, or whatever. But we got to know what our particular gifts are and work with what we have been given by God. Now, while I don't believe you should depend on anyone to tell you what your destiny is, I do believe that people you encounter will confirm your gift or gifts by virtue of demand. Do people ask you to do what you do? Do they request? For example, if I just talked about cooking, let's say you like to bake. Now, if you are really good at baking and people taste your product, they're going to want more. If you do a fantastic job making cakes, designing cakes, some people, I've seen some fantastic designs of cakes and just really magnificent. Is there a demand for what you do, or do people place a demand? Because people don't place a demand on that that does not meet their needs. There's an expression that I've heard used in the marketplace, and we're talking about the marketplace because living your dreams is about a lot of things, but it happens in the marketplace. That's bringing your gifts and talents to the marketplace where you make it happen. So you want to bring your seed and not your need. Bring your seed and not your need. Once again, you don't have to depend on anyone else to tell you what your destiny is, but people will confirm it. They will let you know by virtue of their requesting the service of what you do. It's really that simple. It's not rocket science. And since I mentioned it, you either have a clear aptitude for understanding that brand of science or you don't. There's no in-between when it comes to understanding rocket science. But what are you good at? I mean, what are you really good at? What is it that you do that you could almost do with your eyes closed? And what is it that you would do for free? What is that thing? Well, that thing that you spend your time doing that is effortless, more than likely, it's a gift that you have, and you want to cultivate that gift. Never in my life have I ever seen anyone storm out of a room and pout because they were informed that rocket science is not a career path for you. Nobody gets upset about, oh, you're not a rocket scientist. Oh, what do you mean I'm not a rocket scientist? Rocket scientist. Well, okay, they just kind of move on and go on to the next thing. They don't pout about it. Don't get upset because you insulted me. What do you mean I'm not a rocket science just because I don't understand simple math? Let me give you another example. There are people passionate about singing while clearly lacking the gift to do so. Will plug their ears and sing, la, 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 you're so dumb because you can't see that I'm a great singer. You can't see the great singer that I am. American Idol auditions have served as the perfect platform for the world to meet people convinced that they can sing, only to have four people on a panel concur that the contestant will not bring joy to a stadium full of people waiting to be inspired by someone that is truly gifted with the voice of an angel. They're saying, that's not you. And it's kind of amusing to watch that happen, to watch people believe that they can sing. I mean, with all of their heart, they are convinced that they are there's nobody that sings better, and get upset when people do not agree with them. Well, there's a reason. It's not hard to hear a cat screeching and understand that that's not a pleasant sound. It's not a mental leap to understand the sound of a dog howling is not something you want to listen to for an extended period of time. That's just not the way it is. What am I saying? Well, I think it's obvious what I'm saying. I just want to reemphasize that as you pursue living and manifesting your dreams, that you must truly understand and be honest about your gifts and abilities. And you have to learn to listen. You have to learn to listen to things that are sometimes unpleasant. You know what? Life's too short for spinning your wheels trying to do something it's been proven you don't have the grace to do. It's just too short. It's just too frustrating. There's something about the truth that when you face the truth in yourself, then it allows you to get past those things that are not beneficial to you as it relates to living the type of lifestyle that you want based on the gifts that are inside of you. You don't want to spend time trying to cultivate something that you really don't have the aptitude to do. Why not focus on what you do really well? And when the way you understand that you do something really well is other people let you know. It's just that simple. Other people will let you know. You don't even have to ask. When you do something well, people will acknowledge it. Realizing your dreams in real time requires more of us than wishful thinking and hoping. You've got to do something. Life's not just for sitting up hoping and wishing. You got to get involved. I believe one of the most powerful and necessary character traits a person must have in their quest, on their journey to manifesting their dreams is honesty. That's a very important character trait. Not just with other people, not just being honest with other people, but with yourself. When you are honest with yourself concerning what you are capable of, dream building becomes far more efficient and productive because you're not majoring in minor issues. Once again, you're not majoring in minor issues. Another character trait that I think is really paramount to success is courage. Multimillionaire business coach Ken Brown says it this way. Scared money can't make money. Scared money can't make money. You've got to have the intestinal fortitude to invest in and sweat for your goals. See, we love to be inspired. We love the stories of people that overcame the odds. But we'd like to avoid all of that work and just go right to the prize. Go right straight to the millions of dollars just showing up magically in our bank accounts. But guess what? That's not how it works. Without courage, you may as well remain seated because Courage is the one quality that will lift you past the challenges you will face on your journey to fulfilling your highest aspirations. Now, here's a story I heard told by personal development speaker Jim Rohn. I won't tell it word for word, but I will share the core ideas, and I believe you'll find it useful. At least that is my hope, is that you will find this information useful. It's called The Four Ifs That Make Life Worthwhile. The Four Ifs That Make Life Worthwhile. Number one. Life is worthwhile if you learn. You've got to have information. You've got to have information to be able to build your dreams properly. Because there's nothing worse than being stupid. Unless you're broke. Broke and stupid. Now that's really bad. Now what's really, really bad is if you're sick. Sick. Broke and stupid. That's really a negative life to live. Sick, broke, and stupid. You can't really fall much farther than that unless you're ugly. Now that is the ultimate negative life. Ugly, sick, broke, and stupid. Trust me when I tell you, information is key. You must be informed. You must inform yourself. You must learn. You must learn yourself. You must learn other people. You must learn life itself. But life is worthwhile if you learn. Number two, life is worthwhile if you try. You can't know your true potential unless you get out there and try it. There's nothing complicated about that. You can't sit there and think about it. You got to get out there and give it a shot. You got to step up to the plate and take a swing. It doesn't matter if you strike out. What is important is that you step up and that you try and that you continue to try. Number three, life is worthwhile if you care. If you care at all, you can get some results. Just a little bit. I mean, if you just care a little bit, you can get some results. If you care enough, you can get extraordinary results. So cultivate your caring character. Number four, life is worthwhile if you stay. Some people quit when things get a little hot and uncomfortable in the field. But if you want to reap the harvest in the fall, you've got to persevere during the summer. You've got to stick it out. You've got to find a way to endure the heat and continue to protect and cultivate your garden. Don't give up in the middle of what you're doing. See it through. That's an abbreviated version, but I hope you get the point. Number one, life is worthwhile if you learn. Number two, life is worthwhile if you try. Number three, life is worthwhile if you care. And number four, it's worthwhile if you stay. My final point on today's subject matter is this. If you're really serious about manifesting your dreams, you need a coach. Yes, you need a coach. A coach can save you years of fruitless effort and frustration. Now, I want you to think about that for a moment. Someone has 20 years of experience. 20 years of ups and downs, 20 years of mistakes and triumphs, mountaintop experiences, valley experiences, the whole gamut. And you have the opportunity to be mentored, to be coached by such an individual. That will take years of mistakes off of your dream building process. Absolutely years of frustration that you can avoid by benefiting from someone else's knowledge, information, and wisdom. So if you're serious about manifesting your dreams, you need a coach that can guide you through the path. Imagine if you were going on a hike. You wouldn't go hiking through a land that you have never been to. At least I hope you wouldn't. Because the person that's been there, they know the terrain. They know where the holes are. They know where the places that exist, where the cliffs are, where you could fall over or fall off the cliff. A guide is going to save you a lot of misfortune. So, once again, if you are serious about manifesting your dreams, hire a coach. I know that personally for me, it has made a tremendous difference in my own life. So that's why I can recommend it to you, because I've experienced it myself. Ready to take your dreams to the next dimension? DM me on Facebook or Instagram, and let's get you connected with the right people and resources to make your dreams manifest. You've been listening to The Spectrum with Bob Ivory. Thank you so much for tuning in. We'll see you next time.
Queens, the Bronx, Stan, and money-making Manhattan. You're listening to Bashani Radio App, the number one independent app for podcast. Download for free for iPhone and Android at the App Store.